Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated.
This morning there are two causes to be submitted by oral argument. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Transportation Insurance Company versus Morial from El Paso County. And Remington Arms Company, Incorporated versus the Honorable Terry Canales, Judge, on original mandamus proceeding. The court will take a recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments. We have allotted 25 minutes for each side to present argument in the first cause and 20 minutes for each side to present argument in the second cause. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application to do so with the clerk of our court. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Transportation Insurance Company versus Morial.
May it please the court, Mr. Haddon will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Charles Haddon representing Transportation Insurance Company. The court has granted writ on 7 points of error. While I'm happy to discuss any questions the court might have about any of those, I think I could be most helpful to the court, and I'd like to focus on the Burke royalty issue, and if I have additional time remaining, the constitutionality of the punitive damages. This case presents the court with a much-needed opportunity to revisit Burke royalty. It's a decision that has created confusion from the very day it was written, and has been the subject of law review articles, dissents, concurrences, and a variety of comment on it. We see there being three glaring inconsistencies in the decision. First of all, on the one hand, it defines gross negligence in terms of an entire want of care and instructs the reviewing court to look at all the facts and circumstances. But on the other hand, it adopts a test for reviewing legal sufficiency that instructs the court to disregard evidence of care. A second inconsistency is that Burke royalty distinguishes between gross negligence and simple negligence, but on the other hand, it adopts a test that in practice has resulted in the blending of those two concepts. In effect, simple negligence has been used to uphold verdicts of gross negligence. A third inconsistency is that the court was concerned that there was nearly automatic reversal of gross negligence verdicts under the test before Burke royalty. Since Burke royalty has come down, there is virtually automatic affirmance of gross negligence verdicts.
Counselor, we changed the test. Won't we don't want the pendulum swing back the other way, the way it was before Burke royalty?
I think that the test that we're proposing, Your Honor, would wind up somewhere in the middle. What we're suggesting to the court is a solution that we hope addresses all of these inconsistencies. What we would like to see the court adopt is a test that still requires the defendant to show that there's no evidence of an entire want of care that would suggest conscious indifference to the rights and welfare of the plaintiff. In order to do so, however, the defendant could use evidence that it took some significant care that shows concern for those rights and welfare. And we use significant care here in the sense that Judge Garwood used it in the Maxey versus Freightliner case out of the Fifth Circuit. And what he was referring to there was that the defendant exercised care with the intent of avoiding injury to the plaintiff and those who are similarly situated to him. Now, the defendant, we would suggest that the defendant may use and the court may look at all the evidence in the case. However, if the evidence of a particular act of significant care is in conflict, if it goes both ways on that issue, that's a jury question. The jury was free to resolve it whichever way they came down. That pays homage to the rule that the evidence should be looked at in a light most favorable to the jury verdict. But there's another situation, and that is where the evidence is not in conflict when you're trying to show an act of significant care, where the evidence is all in one direction, but it's the direction that favors the defendant. Now, under this court's rule in Texas and New Orleans Railroad versus Burden, and that's not a case that we cite in our brief, so I'll give you the citation. I believe it's 203 Southwest 2nd. It either starts at page 530 or the spot site is at 530. The court said that the jury has not the right to disregard undisputed evidence. It can resolve conflicting evidence, but it has no right to ignore evidence that is one-sided, that goes one way. We would suggest under this test that where the defendant can show undisputed evidence demonstrating that it took significant care that expresses concern for the rights and welfare of the plaintiff, that that defeats the entire want of care, it defeats the concept of conscious indifference, and that the court should look at that and apply that as its test. And we see this test that I've just announced to you as addressing many, if not all, of the problems. It's faithful to the definition of gross negligence that was adopted in Burke Royalty. It gives meaning to the court's direction in that case to look at all the facts and circumstances, because you are looking at all the facts and circumstances. It defeats the logical inconsistency of focusing on the mental state of the defendant and whether there was an entire want of care and conscious indifference, and then ignoring the actual care that the defendant took. But on the other hand, it preserves the jury's right to resolve disputed questions of fact, because if there is a dispute, if there's evidence going both ways, or at least evidence of more than a mere scintilla going both ways, then the jury is free to resolve that in whatever manner they see fit. However, it does not allow the jury to do what this court has said it may not do, and that is disregard undisputed evidence. We think by landing somewhere in the middle of these two tests, the pre-Burke royalty and the post-Burke royalty test, we're going to wind up with not the automatic reversal or the automatic affirmance. We're not going to have a blend of gross negligence and simple negligence that the court, that members of the court have expressed concern about, and that rightly so. It should not be the case that simple negligence subjects a defendant to an award of punitive damages. And finally, I think one of the big concerns in Burke royalty and that the courts have expressed over the years is that some act of insignificant or unrelated care, sufficing pre-Burke royalty to allow defendants to escape from the verdict of gross negligence. Judge Garwood said in his, used an example of a hot rodder who turned his lights on but was nonetheless reckless. Well, the turning your lights on because you're driving at night doesn't in any way show care for the people that you're endangering. He was doing it in order so that his buddies on the side could see him better. That type of care isn't what we're talking about. That's not the significant care. What we're talking about is a different type of significant care, and I'll demonstrate in a minute that there was this type of care in our case. You may be concerned that this sounds somewhat like the old some care test pre-Burke royalty, but I think it's different in two ways, both in the quality of the evidence and in the quantity of the evidence. The quality of the evidence is different in that we don't accept, or we suggest that you don't accept, insignificant care, unrelated care, unrelated to the situation of the plaintiff. You focus on whether this really was directed towards the harm that the plaintiff is complaining about. In that sense, it's got to be a step up from where the evidence used to be pre-Burke royalty. And in terms of the quantity, it used to be that some evidence of some care was enough to defeat this. We're not talking about just some evidence. If there's some evidence going one way on a particular act and there's some evidence going the other way, that's not good enough under the test we're talking about. So we've increased the quantity. I think that's why it will fall somewhere in the middle between the automatic reversal and the automatic affirmance.
How would you articulate such a test?
I think the court would say that the test is that that in looking at gross negligence, the court may consider all the evidence, and that the defendant on appeal must show that there was some significant care taken, significant meaning exercise and care with the intent to avoid injury to the individual similarly situated to the plaintiff, and that if there is a dispute in the evidence, that the general rule that the evidence is viewed most favorably to the jury jury verdict prevails and that that evidence would not be sufficient to defeat a finding of gross negligence. But if there is undisputed evidence of some significant care shown by the defendant, then that would be significant. That would be sufficient to defeat a finding of gross negligence.
How would you apply it to a drunk with a suspended license who drove slowly?
And he drove slowly with the intent to avoid injury?
That's right, but he was drunk and he had a suspended license and he killed the second person.
I think the suspended license probably doesn't have much to do with it, and I think the Steve's Industries case would probably support that. I think that there is a question in each case as to what is significant, and that is to be resolved on a case-by-case basis. But we ask the court, the juries and the courts all the time to make those types of judgments as to what is reasonable. In the very cause of action that's at issue here, reasonable is an element of the plaintiff's case, and the jury has to decide whether there was a reasonable basis for the insurance company's action. So it would decide the question based on its own view of what was reasonable, or under our test, what was significant care. And the court would review the decision just as it reviews decisions where juries have made those types of determinations in the past.
Well, I understand how the process would work, but I gather under your significant care test that as long as the drunk with the history of driving while intoxicated drove slowly, that would be some evidence of significant care on his part.
Well, there may be some situations where the test doesn't work completely, and I'm not sure that that's one of them, but I think in this particular case, this test works just fine. The evidence in this case, and I think the best example of significant care, which defeats the entire want of care and which defeats the conscious indifference, is the following. On August 18, 1987, Mr. Moriel's attorney wrote a letter to Transportation Insurance saying that his client had been sued by Providence Hospital for the non-payment of a bill. There were two bills from Providence Hospital. I want to keep them straight. There was about a $7,000 bill, which the company paid without any delay, without any question. The small bill, $382, that was the subject of this subsequent lawsuit. That was August 18th. The evidence was that Transportation had inadvertently failed to pay the bill. As soon as that was brought to their attention, they contacted George Henderson, who was the attorney for the hospital. They arranged for payment of the bill, and by August 22, 1987, within 4 days of the letter having been written, a motion to dismiss the hospital's suit against Mr. Moriel was already on file. That was before Mr. Moriel's counsel even filed an answer to the petition. So what we have here is a situation where the insurance company is being told, here's the very harm that Mr. Moriel is complaining of. I'm hung out to dry by the insurance company because they haven't paid my bills. They're told of this situation and say, well, wait a second, you know, we're going to do something about that. It isn't a case where they didn't care. They didn't say, well, under Smith v. Stevenson, they don't have the right to go against you, just assert that as a defense. They took affirmative, immediate, and effective steps to remedy the alleged harm to Mr. Moriel.
Can you explain why the test you propose is not an invitation to the appellate court to merely substitute its assessment of the evidence for that of the jury?
Justice Cornyn, I think the answer to that is that the appellate court can only step in when the evidence is undisputed. If there is a dispute between the evidence, if for example in my example here, there was some evidence in the record saying, oh no, when Transportation was contacted about the lawsuit, they said, forget it, we don't, Mr. Moriel, let them hire a lawyer and defend us. In that situation, the jury's verdict of conscious disregard or heedless and reckless disregard would have to be honored, and their function of resolving factual disputes would have to be honored. It's only in the situation where there is no contrary evidence or the evidence on the other side is no more than a mere scintilla that the Court of Appeals could step in and say, there is significant care having been taken here, and that will defeat the finding of an entire want of care and conscious indifference. You can't be consciously indifferent towards someone if you're taking some significant concern towards them. Now, the question of whether it's significant or not, again, is a jury issue.
It seems that a balance is still involved, though. If you have one piece of evidence of significant care and five pieces of evidence, either undisputed or resolved in favor of the jury's verdict, of lack of care, is that enough evidence to sustain a verdict or not? What if there were 100?
I don't think, Your Honor.
What if there were 1,000? It seems like there's always going to be some balance.
Well, there are cases, I suppose, where there is an actual entire want of care, and those are the cases that deserve to be called gross negligence and deserve punitive damages. If you go back in the history of punitive damages, they were originally called special damages. They've ceased to be special. They're common and ordinary at this point. We need a distinction between the states of mind that will subject people to ordinary damages or compensatory damages and punitive damages. And if it turns out that the court wants to change its definition of gross negligence, well, that's something else. But we're trying to be faithful to the definition that says an entire want of care and conscious disregard, just didn't care. We knew about it, but we just didn't care. In this situation, we knew about the Providence Hospital suit, and we cared. Mr. Morial was still in the hospital. We sent an adjuster there. We got his compensation payments, his wage replacement payments, started immediately. Paid over $10,000. This is undisputed.
Was that total lost wages, or was that just a weekly compensation?
That was the weekly compensation. He was receiving
checks. So lost wages?
He was receiving checks that replaced his wages during the time he was incapacitated. There was ultimately a $24,500 compensation payment that was made to him at the end.
That was a limited amount of his average weekly wage, was it not?
It was the amount that the policy provided for and that the statute calls for.
$200-something.
$208 a week, something along that.
Because in the brief you keep referring to it as lost wages.
Well, I think we said wage replacement, and I was just attempting to distinguish between the money that was to go to replace his lost earnings and his medical bills. If I misuse the terms, I apologize, but just trying to draw the distinction between medical bills on the one hand and wages on the other. And this is the harm that Mr. Morial is concerned about and that the tort of bad faith is concerned about, is delay or denial of these benefits. These are benefits that he was entitled to. He received those benefits without any question or delay. It was concern on...
What about the Baylor Hospital?
The Baylor Hospital bill... Well, first of all, the Baylor Hospital bill was never attempted to be collected from Mr. Morial, so that's one thing that you should understand about that. The second thing is, if you look at all the evidence, there is evidence in the record that transportation either did not receive or at least did not believe that it had received the report from the hospital discussing Mr. Morial's, explaining Mr. Morial's treatment there. And under Section 8306, or Article 8306, Section 7, neither Mr. Morial nor the insurance company has an obligation to pay a medical bill until the report is received. But even in the worst case, even if transportation failed to pay one of the bills, I don't think that in light of the evidence of their reaction to the Providence Hospital bill, their paying of the undisputed evidence of their paying of the compensation, the undisputed evidence that they paid 15 of his 19 medical bills without question or delay. There were over $15,000 in medical bills that were paid without delay. And compare some of those. So there were two bills from Providence Hospital at the same time, one for $7,000, one for $382. And no one yet has offered an explanation as to why the insurance company would purposely not pay a $382 bill and yet pay a $7,000 bill, other than mere inadvertence. And that was the explanation of the adjusters. They didn't know that they had the bill. There's some testimony in the hospital records that the hospital contacted the adjuster. The adjuster said, I think I just paid that bill. If I haven't, I just paid it last week. If I haven't, call me back, and the hospital never called back. So she rightly, or incorrectly, but naturally believed that it had been paid. So this was...
The jury resolved that issue against you.
Well, I think that... I don't know that there was a dispute of the evidence. Mr. Morial even said that there's no question that there was a delay in that, and we haven't challenged the legal sufficiency of the finding of the bad faith tort. But on conscious indifference, even Mr. Morial testified that it could have been an error. Where the inference to be drawn from the delay can go either way, that is, under even the traditional test, that's no evidence of conscious indifference. You can't draw that inference when it goes equally in either direction. There was no intent. The only evidence with respect to intent on anything in here was by transportation's personnel that they never intended to take advantage of Mr. Morial. There's a line in the Court of Appeals decision that is pure fantasy. It talks about some purposeful desire because this was an embarrassing situation to dissuade Mr. Morial from following up on his lawsuit, but there was never any evidence that supported that.
Any other questions? Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Bramblett will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Kit Bramblett and I represent Juan Carlos Morial. There is a typographical error in our brief in response to their writ of application for error, and it's on page 7. It's a figure of $43,000 and it should be $2,075. In the beginning, I'm going to ask this court to read two separate briefs that were set out. They're sent down here and they're a transcript. They were filed in the Court of Appeals in El Paso. One of them is Appellee's Supplemental Brief, filed May 10, 1991, and the other one is Appellee's Response to Appellant Supplemental Brief, filed June 10, 1991. The reason that I ask you to read these briefs and the reason I think they're so important is they go through the evidence and the transcript and they set out all the points and the evidence showing just how terribly Juan Carlos was treated. Juan Carlos was a healthy young man of 26 years of age, had a normal sex life, he had a wife, he had two children. When he received uncontroverted workman's comp injury, tables fell on him, fell across his pelvic section, broke part of his pelvis, and injured his genitals. Now, when he got out of the body cast, every time that he'd start to have an erection, he'd have a tremendous amount of pain in his penis. And he wanted to be treated for this. He was asking for treatment. And the insurance company and the adjuster rightly authorized him to go to the sleep center there in El Paso, which was there's only one there. And it at the time was new. And that's where the doctor said he needed to go, and they sent him over there. They did the right thing. But the sleep center wasn't working. And after 3 days of testing, they said, well, you know, this thing's brand new. It's not going to be in order for 2 or 3 months. Those doctors recommended that he go to the sleep center at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Now, I will concede that they started out to pay his bills. I will concede that they put him on weekly workman's compensation. But from the time that he asked to go to that Baylor sleep center, transportation insurance company acted in total bad faith. Number one, they caused about a 3 month delay in him getting down there by first saying, okay, go get a letter from Dr. Garduno. So he has to get an appointment with Dr. Garduno. He goes up there and he gets the letter, takes it back to the adjuster. Time passes. He's already got an appointment for some time in August. This happened in the first part of July. He was in that sleep center in El Paso. He goes up there, he takes a letter from Dr. Gazelli up there. They say, well, this is not a sufficient letter. Go get a letter from Dr. Gordunio. Goes back, gets an appointment with another doctor, gets another letter saying he needs to go to that. Goes back, says, that's not enough. Go back and get a letter this time from Dr. Diaz. Well, he goes and finally gets a letter from Dr. Diaz, and sometime in September, about September the 15th, they approve that he can go down there. they say, we're going to pay the bill. They call the hospital. And, you know, the hospital won't take it in a situation like that unless they know somebody's going to pay that bill. And that's why he couldn't go earlier, because he didn't have the money to pay it, and wasn't anybody authorizing the payment of it. Now, the next thing they did, put a roadblock in his way of ever going down there, is they wouldn't pay his transportation. It cost about $800 at that time to get a round-trip ticket from El Paso to Houston and back. And they just said, we're not going to pay that.
On Southwest Airlines?
That's what it cost at that time. That's what it cost him. And I'm sure he was out borrowing the money. It cost about, I think it was $758, round-trip ticket. Now, the testimony is there in the record. He borrowed the money, and he was able to go. Now, they also stopped him from seeing that hospital for about 3 months, because it took about 3 months to approve him getting there. Now, after they told the hospital that they were going to pay that bill, they still didn't pay it for 2.5 years. They didn't pay that last bill in El Paso to Providence, because this was after the time that he wanted to go down to the sleep center. They didn't pay the path lab bill in El Paso, and they didn't pay Dr. Oscar Pettit, his treating doctor, didn't pay any of these bills for over 2 years. Until they saw the light of the courthouse door when we were down there to try this case, they finally come forward and paid all these bills.
Counsel, were these hospitals contacting Mr. Morrell and asking him to pay?
Well, the bailer did not, they sent him the bill, but they did not look to him for payment. That's a violation of workers' comp law. Now, the hospital in El Paso...
Violation of the law, wasn't it?
Well, the workman's compensation statute provides that if it's a workman's compensation case, the health provider may look only to the insurance company for the payment, not to the person to whom they're giving the treatment.
You said they sent him the bill, but they did not look to him for payment.
They weren't saying, you got to pay this bill.
So how's that a violation? It would have been if they had.
Right, right. That's correct.
So they, but they in answer to Judge Hightower's question, they didn't ask him, they didn't make the man on it.
They did not make demand, as far as I understand the facts. Now, the one in El Paso made demand on him, and they sued him. And
is that the $300 bill? Or?
The $380-something bill, that's correct. And it was not the action of transportation, as Chuck has told you, I think, that stopped that lawsuit. It was my son calling up the hospital and saying, look, you're in violation of the workers' comp act over in the Regis section where it says you can't do this. Now, they did come forward and pay it at that time. There's plenty of evidence they knew about that bill, because right in the middle of the hospital records, which are here in evidence, there's a notation about the employee calling and calling and calling again, and it's in the Providence Hospital record to Virginia Hatson over in Dallas to get that bill paid. Now, Chuck Juan Carlos had an absolute right under the workman's compensation law to pick his own hospital. That's a right. He can pick his own doctor. He can pick his own hospital. And once the determination had been made that he needed to go to a sleep center, and one in El Paso was broke, there should have been no delay in letting him go to the next available hospital. You know, if your leg's broke and the hospital door's shut, you go to the next one. Not so in this case. They delayed him for 3 months.
Do you see any inconsistencies in the Burke royalty test as it was set out in that case?
Well, I have it in my notes over here to discuss Burke royalty. I think that Burke royalty is just fine the way it is. I think that what they're advocating, what they want you to do, is merely semantic. They want you to go back to the old sum care test, and they use the word, I believe in this case, significant care. But you know, that's just semantic. That's just an adjective. They're going to be able to get in there and show that, well, they did one thing right, and because they did one thing right or two things right and so forth, he should ignore the entire set of facts, whatever it was they did bad. And I personally.
Well, in judging if there's an entire one up here, which is the Burke Loyalty Standard, how can we do that without at some point looking at what the defendant did right?
Well, I think that you have to look at all of the evidence, okay? But then I think you have to follow the standards that you set out in Burke Royalty, wherein you look at all that evidence, and then you decide if there is enough evidence to support the verdict, and you decide if it is not so contrary and overwhelmingly contrary to the fact, then the verdict should be allowed to stand.
Mr. Brandon, doesn't that make punitive damages a jury question in every case where there's some evidence of ordinary negligence?
Well, first, you have to get the trial court to submit it. First, you've got to plead it. And then you've got to get the trial court to submit it. And I submit to you that evidence of negligence, okay, is not going to be submitted by the trial courts around over this state. Simply, or that if you have evidence of negligence, that the trial courts are not going to be submitting issues on gross negligence simply with the presentation of some negligence. What they're advocating will, in effect, get rid of all of the gross negligence verdicts that have been had in this country, or that will be had in the future, and, you know, they'll have a license to go out there and do whatever they want to do. It'll be kind of like the situation we all got ourselves into when we did away with the capital punishment. We did away with capital punishment, and now today all the prisons are running over, and we can't build them fast enough, and the people can't even stay down there, you know, one-tenth of their time. Back when we had capital punishment, you know, we didn't have that problem. Now, we do away with all kinds of punitive damages, and they can do whatever they want to, because then all they could be forced to pay is what they should have paid in the first place. I want to...
The $101,000 actual damage award, which is not being attacked here, as I understand it, is some multiple of the amount that the insurance company delayed in paying, isn't it?
What did you... I didn't know.
You received a jury award of $101,000 actual damages, correct?
Yes.
And that included more than just what the insurance company was slow pay on. That included some mental anguish.
That was mental anguish and actual damage. That's correct.
But it was more than just these bills that were delayed for 2 years.
That's right. But here's the thing about it. They did all this, as the court in El Paso gleaned from the evidence, as they figured out, and as the trial court figured out, they did all these things after he wanted to go to that state center and so forth down there, and just wouldn't pay anything and do nothing, and dug their heels in and stonewalled everything to force a workman's compensation settlement. That's why they did all that. In the court in El Paso, the trial court there and the Court of Appeals all figured that out. And the jury figured it out. That's why they did it. And that's why the jury came back hammered. Was because they, you know, just didn't do anything right from the time he said, I want to go to that sleep center down there in Houston, from that time on.
Does it make sense to force a settlement if you end up paying all the bills?
They didn't end up paying them until the day of the trial.
But they still paid them all. Why? You don't get much out of a settlement if you end up paying it.
They were trying to force a settlement. Judge Heck, when you're going to trial, you're defending in a situation like that, and you're the lawyer, you're going to tell them when you get on there and trial, look, you're going to pay those bills because they're uncontroversial. See, they didn't controvert any of these bills up to workers' compensation vote, okay? And if you're going to say that a bill is unjust, too high, or something wrong with it, you got to controvert. They didn't do it. They knew they owed those bills. We went up to them just like we did not controvert a single one of them. Wouldn't pay them either.
Mr. Haddon argues that it's just as consistent that the... at least some of them were overlooked. What's your response to that?
Well, his his witness, or Mr. Pulis's witness, Vicki Stansel, came down there and said, we just didn't know anything about that Providence bill when he got sued over. It was her testimony in the record. We didn't know anything about it. Well, we introduced into evidence the hospital records, which indicate they'd been talking to her on several occasions. And it's in evidence. Y'all can review it if you want to. It's right there in the middle of their record. And the jury just thought she was lying. They also said that they didn't know anything about the PAT lab bill. That's a bill for some $250-$260. But it's post-Bader. Okay? They said they didn't know anything about it. But in answer to the interrogatory that were sent out a good while before the trial, they acknowledged they knew about it. And those answers to interrogatories are here in evidence before this court. They were in evidence before the trial court and the Court of Appeals in El Paso. And they did. There's plenty of evidence that the jury could figure out they did know about those bills, like the bill from Dr. Pettis. They knew he was being treated by Dr. Pettis, but for over 2 years they wouldn't treat him because Dr. Pettis was the doctor that treated him after he came back from Baylor, which is where they didn't want him to go in the first place. Juan Carlos was asking for help. He was begging for help. And when his insurance company wasn't ignoring him, they were lying to him. Now,
counsel, do you see any problems with our Burke royalty standard under the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Hadley?
No, sir, I do not. I think that under the Hadley case, that our system of justice and Burke royalty too gives a defendant more protection than the Alabama court system gives. In Texas, everybody's entitled to a jury trial. That's not true in every other state in the union. We use it better than anybody. In Texas, we use a system of instructions to the jury that's bigger than anybody else's in the whole world. We use a set of special issues that are very particular and give the railroads and the insurance companies and big corporations all kinds of loopholes and give them all kinds of benefit of the doubt. But so be it. That's our system. And it's a good one. Then, if in our system the jury is led astray or goes astray, our trial court has the right to grant a new trial, to grant a motion NOV to give judgment disregarding that jury verdict, or they have the right to order remittiture. Now, our system also provides an intermediate appellate step, which the Alabama system does not provide. We have an appellate court that likewise can reverse and remand a case for a new trial. They can order remittiture. Or they can reverse and render a case. I lost a $400,000 judgment in El Paso 2 or 3 years ago against a bunch of cow crooks. They reversed and rendered that. After I'd won it at the jury, they took it away. And that's their right, and that's their job, to look at all the evidence and see if you submitted it right, which I didn't. And because of technicality, we lost it. And lastly, in order to show due care as required by the Haskell case, our system of justice allows an appeal up here to the Supreme Court where any litigant can come up here and have this court review all questions of law. And that includes all the rules and regulations under which the courts of appeal work. I would like to address a couple more issues that they've raised in their brief. One is this four times cap in the Civil Remedies and Practice Code, Chapter 41. Number one, this case was filed before that became the law. Number two, the court in El Paso properly found that they had waived any point of error on that issue. Number three, 41007, the four times cap, does not apply to an intentional tort. In this case, the jury found, you'll read special issue number two, that transportation's acts and conduct were all committed knowingly, intentionally done. The jury made that finding. Number four, it doesn't apply because the statute says what it does apply to, and it says it applies to negligence, strict liability, and breach of warranty. Now, this court has ruled before if the legislature passes law says it applies to A, B, and C, then that's who it applies to and not X, Y, and Z. And fifth, the legislature recognized that that four times cap does not apply to a workman's compensation bad faith case because in 89 when they passed the new workman's compensation law over there in 8308 and then at 1042, they specifically put a cap on bad faith cases in insurance bad faith. So, you know, the legislature recognizes it doesn't apply, and I submit to you it does not apply. There's one other thing that I want to discuss briefly, and that's this Dominguez case. And I would point out to you that the Dominguez case came out of the Court of Appeals in El Paso, wherein they ruled that because of a judgment that was entered in that case, that the gentleman, Mr. Dominguez, could not then assert a bad faith claim because he'd waived it, made judicial admissions or was collaterally stopped and couldn't do it. Now, they did not apply, the Court of Appeals in El Paso did not apply Dominguez to find that Juan Carlos couldn't bring his case. And I think there are two real distinctions that have to be made in deciding that the court in El Paso was right. The first distinction is that in Juan Carlos, there is a lot of saving language in the judgment saying that we're going to preserve all elements of the bad faith claim. And the court made findings of that effect. And in the Dominguez case, there are absolutely no there's absolutely no saving language in that case whatsoever. Now, the wording is considerably different. In Juan Carlos's case, it says, and it appearing to the court that the extent of the injury and liability for compensation or medical expenses are uncertain, that they're going to pay certain things. In the Dominguez case, Dominguez signed the judgment. In Juan Carlos's case, he did not sign the judgment, but in Dominguez's case, Dominguez agreed. It says in that opinion and judgment, Dominguez agreed that the appellant's liability was indefinite, uncertain, incapable of being exactly established or determined. Now, I submit to you that those are certainly different statements, and in light of the fact that you have to read the whole partial settlement judgment in Morrell, certainly Dominguez is not controlling and should not be a reason to find that there cannot be any punitive damages in this case. This is not, this case that we're here arguing about today is not the only case where a jury has found transportation to be guilty of the same things that they were guilty of in that. There's a case coming up here. It's called Transportation versus Archer. It's over in the Second Court of Appeals now, and it's the same thing. It's just, you know, over in that court case, they pled course in conduct of habit and conduct, and they brought in an Alabama case where the Alabama Supreme Court found their parent company guilty of the same thing. Now, over in Alabama, it's called tort of outrage, and they found that they were trying to force workers' compensation settlements on people by denying and stopping the payments.
Now, is that in the Tyler Court of Appeals or in the state of Alabama? I'm confused.
The first one is in, the first one that I cited to you, which is Transportation versus Archer, is in the Second Court of Appeals.
Is that in your brief?
I don't think it's in my brief.
All right.
I don't think it's in my brief. David Keltner gave that to me, and he was going to argue this case, and he got tied up in trial and couldn't come. Now, I have a copy of both the brief in that case and the opinion of the Alabama Supreme Court. In the Tyler case, they cited the Alabama Supreme Court case and were able to present that to the jury. Lastly, I would simply ask this court to uphold the judgment of the court in El Paso and the trial court, because I think there will be a lot of little people, a lot of everyday people in Texas that will get hurt tremendously if you go back and revisit Burke Royalty and put in some kind of a semantic distinction that's going to let them show, well, we were driving down the road with both hands on the wheel. Or, yeah, we did pay one or two things. We did do something right. And then avoid all punitive damages. If we get back to the old pre-Burke Royalty standard, we're not ever going to hold, as we did not for 10 or 12 years before Burke Royalty, any gross negligence cases against insurance companies for bad faith. Are there any questions?
Prior to Burke Royalty, there was not a bad faith tort against insurance companies. Burke Royalty was 4 years before Alana.
Right. Before, I understand that. But Burke Royalty set out the standards by which you review those numbers. And what they're asking you to do is go back and change those standards now that we have bad faith against insurance companies, and they won't change, so they're going to stack the deck. And I submit to you that this court should not put itself in a position of reviewing or having to review, as Justice Gonzalez said in some of his other opinions, having to review all of the factual cases that come up through the courts of appeals. You don't want to be, and really it's not, I don't think it's what the Constitution prescribed anyway. The Constitution said that this court should review questions of law, and that the Court of Appeals opinion should be conclusive as to questions of evidence. But if you go back and change that Burke Royalty thing, one of the things you're inviting is to go do a factual sufficiency of the evidence review of all those Court of Appeals cases. I don't think it's the law, and I don't think it should be.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, picking up on this last line of questions, you're not asking us to carve out any special part of the Burke Royalty test or change it just for claims on bad faith against insurance companies. The rule you're talking about would apply to repeat offender DWIs and to manufacturers that have known defects in their products. It would apply to everyone.
That's correct, Your Honor. The problems with Burke Royalty existed before there even was a tort of breach of duty, good faith, and fair dealing that applied to insurance companies. We think that they have an impact on insurance companies, and that's why we're here in this case. Mr. Bramblett has just said that the problem with the test that we suggest is that if there's one act of care, then we beat the rap. First of all, that isn't what we're saying. It has to be some significant care, and it has to be undisputed evidence of that. But the problem with Burke Royalty is that if there's any act of something that the insurance company did wrong, or anyone does wrong in a gross negligence case, then that will affirm the result in affirmance of the finding of gross negligence. It doesn't look at the entire state of mind of the defendant.
I believe you said you got your significant care standard from Justice Garwood's 1982 concurrence in Maxie against Freightliner?
In the en banc.
Who has adopted it since he advocated it in the concurrence?
I'm sorry, who
has... jurisdictions have adopted it since he advocated it?
Your Honor, I don't think any jurisdiction outside of Texas has the system of no evidence review that we have here. So it doesn't really apply. I don't think any court has followed that opinion. We think it's just right as a matter of persuasion. That's what we're offering as a test here. But because of the peculiarity of the distinction of the Texas test, no other court really would face that question.
And what about Chapter 41 of the Texas Civil Remedies, Civil Practice and Remedies Code? Do you say that it applies here?
We certainly argued to the court that it applied at the trial level. We made the argument that the remedies code ought to cap these damages at 4-1. I had hoped to talk about punitive damage. They did come up. I'd like to address it very briefly. The Pacific Mutual case, the Supreme Court, after reviewing the procedures and saying there was procedural due process by the Alabama procedures, went on and looked at what the amount of the award was to see if that amount was constitutional. We're asking you to do that here. The court in Pacific Mutual said a ratio of punitives to compensatory damages of 4-1 was close to the line of constitutional impermissibility. They said a ratio of punitives to actual damages of 200-1 was close to the line. In this case, we're way over that line. We've got 10-1 punitive damages to compensatories, $1 million to $100,000, $101,000, and we've got $1 million to $1,000, that's 1,000-1. We obliterate the line that they were talking about in Pacific Mutual. Confirmation of what the line ought to be is provided by virtually every statute that the Texas legislature has adopted relating to punitive damages. There's one, Section 10.42 of the New Workers' Comp Act, Article 8308. It says in exactly this type of case, punitive damages against an insurance company for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, 4-1. That's the maximum permissible ratio. There's a floor of $250,000 that triggers this ratio. But that's the legislature's best judgment as to the amount of deterrence and punishment that's necessary. Even if it doesn't apply in this case, the court should look to that to determine where the constitutional line falls. The remedies code talks about 4-1. The insurance code regulates wrongful handling of insurance claims. That has additional damages of 2-1 ratio. The DTPA, Deceptive Trade Practices, has a 2-1 ratio.
Your argument that when the legislature says a 4-1 cap applies to certain kinds of causes of action but doesn't to others, that it's our job as a court to reach out and apply the 4-1 cap to those causes of actions that they do not cover in the statute?
I think that the legislature has acted broadly enough on this 4-1 cap that you could comfortably apply it to any level, and certainly with the comfort that the Supreme Court of the United States has said that 4-1 is right up at that line of constitutional impermissibility. I think in this case, whether you go beyond bad faith insurance or not, they have said it with respect to the tort of bad faith in the insurance context, that that's what it ought to be. And the only thing I would say is that there are numerous statements of fact that Mr. Bramlett testified to here in front of the court that just aren't in the record, including some of the things that he used to rebut what I said was undisputed. And for the court's convenience, that hospital record could be found at page 388 and 389 of the transcript, and you'll see that it says what I said it said.
Counsel, what does the authority of a Texas trial court to order remittiture or a new trial in the event of a runaway punitive damage award to provide a sufficient procedural safeguard to comply with the due process?
Why does it?
Oh, it not.
Okay.
Mr. Bramlett contended that was a defendant's protection against a runaway punitive damage award, and I'd be interested in your response to that.
Well, I think you have to look at what the Supreme Court viewed as sufficient in the Pacific Mutual case. And in Pacific Mutual, they said that the Alabama system required the court to make its own determination of the reasonableness of the punitive damage award in light of the deterrent, or whether or not it promoted the deterrent purposes and punishment purposes of punitive damages. Our courts, and they have to explain their reasoning whether they remit or leave it as it stands. Our courts, you can ask for a new trial, they don't have to grant it. In this case, we asked for a new trial, it wasn't even ruled on, let alone any explanation as to why the damages were constitutionally or otherwise sufficient. The standard that this court has established is one of excessiveness. It's a factual question. You're going to have to show overwhelming weight of the evidence in your favor. The Supreme Court standard in Pacific Mutual was much more protective than that, and it wanted the court to put in place its own independent judgment as to whether it was reasonably necessary to promote the purposes. The standard in Pacific Mutual said that it was important that the jury was shielded from knowledge of the defendant's wealth. We moved for bifurcation of the trial in this case. It was denied. That was special exceptions before the trial in the case. That information was provided to the jury. On appeal, Again, Alabama requires the Supreme Court to review those decisions, again looking at the reasonableness of the award in light of the punitive and deterrent purposes of punitive damages. Our court will look at it only in terms of the factual sufficiency of the damages. And this court, unlike the Alabama Supreme Court, isn't even free to rule on the factual questions on that matter. So I think there are far fewer protections that are available here. And our juries are not instructed to that punitive damages must be reasonably proportioned as the Alabama court applies. So that's the single most helpful thing they could hear, and they don't even get to hear it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument.
The audience will please rise.